It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. A few weeks ago, we talked about the possibility of a rainbow wave with more than 400 LGBT plus candidates running for office across America. Now that the midterm election is over, we could ask the question, did we see a rainbow wave? Do you think there was a rainbow wave in this election? Do you care how your representatives identify themselves? How important do you think diverse representation is in the legislature or in Congress? Are you motivated to vote for a candidate based on their identity, whatever it may be? And what do you think of the fact that our incoming legislators are the most diverse class ever? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Daniel Bartholomew is a senior graduate student lecturer in the Department of Sociology and LGBT plus Studies at UW-Milwaukee. Daniel, welcome back to the Morning Show.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
We spoke a little before the election about the fact that more than 400 LGBT plus candidates were on ballots all over the country this election. So did we see a rainbow wave?
Again, I would stick to what I said last time in saying that I think calling this a rainbow wave was a bit of an overstatement from the start. To put things into perspective, so there were 430 openly identified LGBT plus folks running for office in the midterm elections. And according to the Victory Institute, which is a national organization that keeps track of all openly identified LGBT plus elected officials in the U.S., 160 out of the 430 won their races. So that's a little over 33%, a little over a third won those races. But even with adding those into the previously openly identified LGBT plus elected officials throughout all levels of U.S. government, the LGBT plus community still remains significantly underrepresented in terms of their overall representation. So suggesting that there was a rainbow wave, I think, implies a bit more strongly what is really happening in politics today.
Let's talk specifically about Congress. How many LGBT plus candidates did we elect, and what percentage of Congress do they now occupy?
So after the midterm elections, we will now be up to 10 openly identified LGBT plus people in Congress. So out of the 435 congressional seats, that ends up being a little more than 2%. So according to the most recent national estimates, it's estimated that about 4.5% of the U.S. population identifies as part of the LGBT plus community. And that number has continued to grow since national polling places have been collecting this data. So we're still only about halfway there in terms of representation in Congress. But if we expand that out to all levels of government throughout the United States, the overall percentage of representation is much lower than that.
And so let's talk about state and local races. How did LGBT plus candidates do there?
So in Wisconsin, we have two of the 10 U.S. Congress positions are actually being of openly identified LGBT plus people come from Wisconsin. So Senator Tammy Baldwin and U.S. Representative Mark Pocan are both in Congress. A few of the other kind of significant LGBT plus races that happened throughout the U.S. was Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona won a kind of drawn out and very close battle to win a seat in the Senate, and she will be the first ever openly identified bisexual woman to serve in the U.S. Senate. Also, another significant race came out of Kansas, where Sharice Davis was the first openly identified LGBT plus individual to win a seat in Congress from that state. And Sharice Davis also made history as being the first Native American woman to be elected into Congress, along with New Mexico's Deb Haaland. A few other significant races, Angie Craig from Minnesota will become the first lesbian mother to ever be elected into Congress. And in terms of the governor races, Jared Polis of Colorado became the first gay man to be elected governor.
Being the first of anything is a position that can come with some pressure. Do you think these candidates will be affected by that or feel the need to work harder or be more active or be more visible on LGBT plus issues?
think that's what the people who voted them into office are hoping for. I think we're currently in a political climate where a lot of people, not just LGBT plus people, but heterosexual identified people too, are feeling dissatisfied or discouraged with the way our government is being run. And so this election cycle, these dissatisfied citizens wanted to get people into office who they truly believe are going to bring about some significant changes. And for better or for worse, the LGBT plus community in the U.S. is associated with radicalism and revolution and social reform. I mean, for instance, it was the mobilization and the grassroots efforts of the LGBT plus community that led to the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and to the legalization of same-gender marriage. So even with the odds stacked against them, the LGBT plus community has had a pretty impressive track record of bringing about social and legal reformations in the U.S. So for a lot of people who want to see some significant changes in government, LGBT plus people running for office are attractive candidates for that reason.
What do you think about the fact that the incoming class of legislators in Congress is the most diverse yet?
I think it says a lot, again, about kind of the culture of the U.S. today. People who are from underrepresented communities, marginalized communities, want to see people who look like them and who share their identities being elected into office so they can have a seat at the table during these important policy decisions. So I think that the increasingly diversified Congress is a trend that we can expect to see continue to intensify in the future.
Are we talking about generational change here?
Absolutely. I mean, we don't have a lot of data in yet, but I think we can anticipate that younger generations are going to become more and more common at the polls in future generations. A lot of the individuals who are running for offices this time particularly targeted their campaigns to motivate younger generations to get out and to vote because they know that that's been a demographic that's been significantly underrepresented at the polls in the past. For example, candidate Beto O'Rourke from Texas, who was running for Senate, didn't win his election, but definitely made some significant gains at getting younger generations to get out to the polls. And I think, again, that's something that people running for office are going to be focusing on in the future, too.
Do diverse candidates campaign heavily on their identity, or is that just one factor about them that really is beside the point?
That's definitely a subjective approach, I would say, but I'd say by and large, it's never just a single issue battle for an individual running into elected office. LGBT plus folks have to deal with the same societal concerns that all other people do as well. You know, their identity in terms of their gender and sexuality is one aspect of who they are, and certainly it does affect the way that they're able to access certain pathways to, access certain privileges or be denied certain privileges in society, but they still have to deal with everyday human issues that all U.S. citizens have to deal with. And so I would say that LGBT plus people running for office are not just focused on issues that are pertaining to their gender and sexual identity.
What would be one policy issue that you would hope gets addressed by the next Congress?
Well, in terms of the LGBT plus community, there's many that still need to be addressed. In a number of states, it's still legal for employers to discriminate against people based off of their gender and sexual identities. There's also a number of states that do not currently recognize hate crimes that are based on gender identity. And another significant issue is that in many states, in order for a transgender person to change their gender identity on their birth certificate, states require that individual surgically modifies their genitalia.
Daniel, we'll have to leave it there. We're out of town. Daniel Bartholomew, sure. Thank you for joining us this morning. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The Wisconsin Public Defender's Office assigns private lawyers to about 40% of cases it takes on. But Wisconsin pays public defenders the lowest rate in the nation, and attorneys are increasingly less willing to take on those cases. Lawyers and lawmakers have been lobbying to raise the rate for the past 20 years. After the most recent unsuccessful attempt to raise the pay rate, one judge in northern Wisconsin has said enough is enough, and he joins us to explain his stance. John Yackel is the circuit court judge for Sawyer County, Wisconsin. Judge Yackel, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Good morning, John.
In the interest of full disclosure, I grew up in Sawyer County. So
did I.
Let's talk about what the public defender shortage looks like in Sawyer County in northwestern Wisconsin.
Well, okay. I'll try to keep that as brief as possible, but Sawyer County is a one-judge county. I have the highest caseload, statistically speaking, in the entire state. We have a tremendous problem with meth and heroin, and we have a large group of indigent individuals, some native, some non-native, and we have a non-growing economic base, basically. We're a tourist industry. And so these drugs are coming in from Milwaukee, from Wausau, from Eau Claire, the Twin Cities, and we have individuals who are bringing large amounts in. They get arrested. They get put on cash bonds. And they qualify for public defenders. And where we are located, it seems like we're about 200 miles from anywhere. And so, under the statutes, the public defenders are required to appoint attorneys for indigent individuals. But in the last year and a half, we've gotten to the point where they simply tell me in court there are no public defenders. And so I'm left in those situations with three very, very unattractive choices. I could violate a defendant's constitutional rights by letting them sit in custody. I can ignore the safety of the public by simply releasing them without any type of bond. Or I can destabilize my county resources by appointing them a county attorney and not get paid back by the public defender. And so I'm faced every week and every day with what to do in order to keep my oath to not violate anyone's constitutional rights. I mean, my oath is to uphold and defend the Constitution. I live in this town, so I don't want to put public safety at risk. And I certainly, as a taxpayer, am concerned about having my county pay for something that the state should be paying for.
Is this a problem that is more felt in Sawyer County than in other parts of rural Wisconsin, or is this generally a rural problem statewide, do you think?
It is a problem statewide, but I can tell you that with the heavy caseload that Sawyer County has, this is an issue that popped up everywhere else. So the other rural counties are probably 9 months behind where we are. They're still getting attorneys. It's taking a long time to find attorneys, but we're at the point now where we're simply being told there are no attorneys. And so here's a little secret that people need to understand. Under our system of government, and when you have law enforcement go out and do their job, and you have the district attorneys do their job, and you get into court and a bond is set and there's a charging document, if there is no lawyer that is willing to take that defendant's case, we can't process that case. That person, if they're innocent, can't go forward and say, hey, there is no case against me. I want this dismissed, or I want a jury to find me not guilty. And for the person who may be guilty, there's no way to move it forward to a jury trial so that the jury can say, you're guilty. It simply stops and it stalls. And I don't think people realize how difficult or how bad living in a society that you can't prosecute criminal offenses is going to be.
The state of Wisconsin pays $40 an hour when private attorneys have to be hired to act as public defenders. But when you have to appoint someone from Sawyer County at county expense, how much is Sawyer County paying for those attorneys?
That's set by Supreme Court Rule, 81.02. And that is $70 an hour. But in the in May, the Supreme Court raised that to $100 an hour, and I think that's going to take effect in either 2019 or 2020. And so that's going to add an even greater burden to the county coffers if I have to keep appointing county attorneys and not get any reimbursement back from the state.
You've ordered representatives from the state public defender's office to come to Sawyer County in January, basically to explain themselves. What do you hope to accomplish?
Well, at the time I did that, what my intent was is basically ringing the alarm bell that in rural Wisconsin, especially in Sawyer County, we have reached the breaking point, that the system with the heaviest caseload and not being able to process these current cases, it's just going to snowball out of control. Since that time, since I made that order, I have received repeated reassurances from members of the state legislature, both state senators, assemblymen from both parties, and even from individuals in the court system, that they are placing this at the highest priority level come January to address this. So I'm evaluating the situation to determine whether or not I have at least raised awareness of this issue, at least for rural Wisconsin. It's always easy if you're a judge or a legislator that comes from an area where things are going well to just say, yeah, you know, we know it's a problem, but we're going to get to it, as opposed to someone like me who is right in the middle of the crisis going, you need to do something now. I was promised that it was going to be done last biennium. I'm being told that it's going to be taken up very early on in the next biennium. So I think that I've made the maximum amount of noise that I could make on this issue, and we'll see how this plays out. But it is definitely a crisis situation.
Well, as my mother always used to say, talk is cheap. It takes money to buy horses. So I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens. John Yackel is the circuit court judge for Sawyer County, Wisconsin. It's a county in the far northwestern part of the state, an extremely rural area with a lot of indigent defendants, by which we mean people who don't have any money. This problem isn't new in Wisconsin, Judge Yackel. Why did you decide that now was the time to do something about it? What was the moment where you made this decision, you know what, I've had it, this has got to stop?
Well, it because it got to the point now where, if I guess here's the way I look at it, when somebody gets when they have their liberty deprived because I placed them on a cash bond and I can't move their case forward, I've been pointing county attorneys. However, I have cases now where people are charged with felonies, but they're not the most severe felonies in the world, or their involvement in them is slight. So they're on small cash bonds or signature bonds, and those individuals have gone 6 months without getting an attorney. And I'm not too concerned about those individuals and their rights being violated, because their liberty is not being deprived. It's a crisis situation when somebody is sitting in custody and it's more than just a week or two, and they don't have an attorney and their case can't move forward. So when I started seeing that these people who are not in jail, taking 6 months, 9 months to get an attorney, that's where I realized that this system has completely ground to a halt if you can't even get beyond the initial stages of a criminal proceeding because there is no attorney.
So let's say the legislature acts and the governor signs into law some piece of legislation that increases the pay for attorneys to take public defender cases. Even if that happens, isn't there still a shortage of public defenders statewide? What do we need to do to really address this issue once and for all?
That's above my pay grade. I'm simply here to say what the problems are and how it's affecting this legal system. From what I've been told by public defenders, yes, raising the rate of the private bar attorneys is important. To what amount, I don't know. I think they need to restructure the state agency, the state public defender, so that I was reading over in Michigan that they've structured it in some way that there was an absolute guarantee that the public defender's office would receive and would appoint an attorney some way, shape, or form for these individuals, rather than just replying to the judge, well, we've searched 900 attorneys and nobody is willing to take the case. And that's what's happened to me. I regularly inquire, and they say, well, we've asked 900, 1,200 attorneys and no one will take the case. That's when I started getting into those numbers. That's when I said we're at the crisis point.
So if the legislature fails to act and we don't get any movement on this, what else can you do other than raise awareness about this issue?
I've already explained to my county that they need to lobby Madison because the pointing of county attorneys is going to continue. and our county is going to have to pay for it. And if they get to the point where they refuse to pay it anymore, then I only am left with the two choices of either violating a defendant's constitutional rights or ignoring the public safety. And well, that's not going to be a good choice.
Well, let's hope that the legislature can actually do something about this problem. But thank you for bringing it to our attention. John Yackel is Circuit Court Judge for Sawyer County, Wisconsin. Judge Yackel, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us this morning.
Thank you, John. I really appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
You too. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we're going to talk about pie. That sounds good. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Well, for lots of us, pie has a special place at the table during holiday gatherings like Thanksgiving. We turn to a Wisconsin baker to consider how to make pie crust, which is probably the most important thing about baking a pie, at least in the host's opinion. How to troubleshoot various baking challenges is something else we'll talk about, and the role that pie plays in our holiday culinary experience. What pies do you make or buy for the Thanksgiving holiday? Do you make your own pie crust? Do you use butter, lard, vodka? What's your preferred method? Or do you buy ready-made crusts at the grocery store? What's your favorite pie and why? And what do you find the most challenging or trickiest thing about making a pie? Join us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Plenty of room at the table for your pie story. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jerry Bichard is the owner of Norske Nook, a regional restaurant chain with locations in Rice Lake, Hayward, DeForest, and Osseo. He's also the co-author of the Norske Nook Book of Pies and Other Recipes. Jerry, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, I love the saying, life is short, eat dessert first, which is always the first thing I notice when I walk into a Norske Nook restaurant. That makes me laugh every time.
Yeah.
And I follow that, you know? I mean, hey, why not eat dessert first? What, in your opinion, makes a good pie?
I think a lot of it has to do with making it from scratch. I mean, I really believe that every pie crust should be hand-rolled, and I believe that the ingredients need to be fresh and the best quality ingredients, and, of course, a little bit of great Wisconsin dairy products in there, too.
Yeah. All right. Well, we are in the dairy state, so let's talk about the components. Hand rolling is important. Is there one ingredient that you think is, okay, you got to use this in order to have a great pie crust, for example?
Well, we found over the course of the years, thanks to Helen Meyer, the previous owner, which I purchased in 1990, but the butter-flavored Crisco seems to be the best. We've tried everything, and for consistency, the butter-flavored Crisco is probably the best. And, of course, it's a lot of combinations of the flour and you know, making sure you got a little bit of salt and just a little bit of ice-cold water in there. And the more you bake and the more you make crust, the more you realize what the crust should feel like. And that's really important, because flour can vary.
Pie has become to be a really big part of our holiday experience. What is it about pie that makes it so special and so commonly consumed at this time of the year?
I think it's just, it brings back that nostalgic sense of family. I know that for us, throughout the year, we have many different flavors of pie, and this time of the year is when everyone orders the standards, the pumpkins, the apples, the blueberries, the peach, you know, those types of great traditional pies. We have a few variations of those, like a pumpkin cream cheese, which is also popular. But still, the basic ones seem to bring that nostalgia out at this time of the year.
Let's open this up to our listeners. What pies do you make or buy for the Thanksgiving holiday? Do you make your own pie crust? Do you use butter, lard, butter-flavored Crisco, regular Crisco, or some other vegetable shortening? What's your preferred method? Do you have a secret you'd care to share with us? Or do you buy ready-made crusts at the grocery store? What's your favorite pie, particularly this time of the year? And what is it that makes it your very favorite? And then maybe you could talk about what the most challenging or trickiest aspect is about making pie. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can send an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's take a call from Margo, who joins us in Madison. Margo, good morning.
Good morning. A few years ago, I went to the Stoughton County Fair, and they didn't have that many submittals, but the one that took the blue ribbon was a blueberry pie with a stamped-out crust, and I said, rural womanhood is in trouble. So the next year, I submitted, and I guess a lot of other women got the same idea because the judge was swamped with submittals. But I did get the blue ribbon for my five-berry wildberry pie that year. And anyhow, that's my story.
What's your secret for making five-berry wildberry pie?
Well, you know, it's red currants, black raspberries, red raspberries, blueberries. I think there might have been gooseberries. Maybe I've got
six. Wow.
Now you just throw in all the different berries, and they have, and you're picking the seeds out of your teeth for a month, but it's delicious.
Well, that's how you know it's good pie, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Margo, thanks so much for joining us. 800-642-1234. I realize that asking someone for a baking secret is kind of like asking someone their age or other questions you're really not supposed to ask. But, we'll ask them anyway, because we ask the hard questions here on The Morning Show, don't we? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. This program, when we had the pitch meeting and we thought about doing this, it really struck me because, A, my mother made pie a lot, and she was really good at it. And B, I discovered that I did not inherit that skill, because the first time I tried to make a pie crust, it looked great, and the filling was an apple pie. The filling smelled good. It smelled great when it was baking. It looked great when I took it out of the oven. And then I tried to cut it, and I discovered that I had somehow or other created the organic version of Kevlar. I tried to sell it to the military, but they already had Kevlar and they didn't need mine. I said, well, listen, you know, it not only will deflect bullets, but you can eat it if your teeth are good enough. And I called my mother and I said, Mom, what happened? And she said, well, did you use ice water? And I said, well, no. And she said, well, was the butter frozen? And I said, no. And she said, well, there you go. So there it is. Ice water. Cube the butter and work it in with your fingers was what she told me to do. And I decided that was more work than I wanted to do, so I started buying my pie crusts. We have lots of other pie stories. Let's hear one. Let's go to Tom in Port Wing. Oops, I'm sorry. We're going to go to Eau Claire first. And good morning, Eau Claire. Thanks for joining us. What's your pie story?
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm just calling in to say hi to Jerry.
Oh, okay. Well, we lost Jerry for the moment. We're getting him back, but I'll convey your greetings. Do you what's your favorite pie and why?
Oh, pumpkin is just totally my favorite, and then apple.
Pumpkin and then apple. I think that a lot of people would be with you on that. Yep. What do you make your own pies?
Yep, homemade.
And if you would care to share one piece of advice for pie makers, what would it be?
Oh, not to put too much ice water in.
Not too much ice water. Okay, I made a note. Thank you. Thanks very much for joining us. Jerry, we've got you back. I'm sorry we had a little technical issue there, but we were talking about what goes into a good pie and how to avoid having big problems. Let's talk about the pies available at the Norske Nook. You mentioned a few of them. I have to say the pie with the pumpkin and the cream cheese is just kills me every year. But apple and pumpkin are the traditional favorites. What else is seasonal, so to speak, at the Norske Nook?
Well, we have a harvest apple this time of the year that's absolutely fantastic. You know, it's has pecans sprinkled on it and Dutch topping and one of my favorites, of course, is a lingonberry apple, which we get the lingonberries from Scandinavia and mix them in with the apples, kind of like you would make a cranberry apple pie, and it's delicious.
Well, I had breakfast, but I'm already hungry just listening to this. Let's go to Jeannie in Wausau. Jeannie, good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling in to give a simple pie crust recipe.
Okay, let's hear it.
It is a cup and a couple tablespoons of flour, and then you use that butter-flavored Crisco, 6 to 8 tablespoons full. You do use ice water. That helps. And you need 6 to 8 tablespoons again, and you do need a pie crust cutter. And that will make it into that nice pliable dough, helps to work it out, you know, and then roll it out, and it is no fail.
All right.
And as far as keeping butter has to be frozen, even if it's not, it still works, folks. Don't buy pie crust.
Okay. I have been admonished.
I couldn't agree with her more. Don't buy pie crust. Just make them yourself.
Man, pie crust shaming. That's just one thing I never expected. Jerry, we're going to continue our conversation with you in just a moment. Jerry Bichard is the owner of the Norske Nook, a regional restaurant chain with locations in Rice Lake, Hayward, DeForest, and Osseo. I think DeForest is the only one I haven't been to. He's also the co-author of the Norske Nook Book of Pies and Other Recipes. What are some of your favorite pies? What's your favorite pie at Thanksgiving? And can you answer this question? Why are pies round? That's what I want to know. Why are pies round? Maybe somebody will answer that question for us at 800-642-1234. Our pie conversation continues on The Morning Show. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Is it really Thanksgiving dinner without pie? Well, maybe that's a rhetorical question, but pie is on our menu this morning. Jerry Bichard, owner of the Norske Nook, a chain of Wisconsin restaurants famous for its pies, is with us this morning, and he is also the co-author of the Norske Nook Book of Pies and Other Recipes. Jerry, we've got a lot of callers on the line, so let's take a call. We will start with Dean calling us from South Texas. Dean, welcome to The Morning Show.
Good morning. I'm calling because I have kind of an unusual pie that I make for Thanksgiving, and I call it naked pumpkin pie.
Okay. What's so special about it?
It has no crust.
No kidding. How does that work?
Well, over time, I've noticed that when I make pumpkin pies for Thanksgiving, a lot of the people will leave their crust on the plate. They eat the inside of the pie, but they leave the crust. So my thought was, why go through the hassle of making a pumpkin pie with a crust if knowing if half the people aren't going to eat the crust.
All right. Dean, thanks for that. Jerry, do you make any crustless pies at the Norske Nook?
No, we haven't tried that. We definitely have not tried that one.
All right, Dean, thanks for sharing that. That's a first. I hadn't heard that one, and nobody in our family leaves the crust behind. Tom is with us in Port Wing next. Tom, good morning. What's your pie story?
Well, good morning, John. I heard earlier that you're from way down south in Sawyer County.
I am. Yeah, I'm a Hayward boy.
Yeah, up north here in Bayfield County, we use, and my daughters use this bear grease to make their pumpkin pie or apple pie crust.
Bear grease?
Yeah.
Jerry, have you ever heard of anyone using bear grease to make pie crust?
No, I have not. That sounds interesting, though. I'm a hunter, and that really sounds interesting.
Well, Tom, thanks for sharing that, and give a shout-out to all my friends in Port Wing. Let's go to Wallace next in Rice Lake. Wallace, good morning.
Good morning. Reporting on the pie crust, first of all, my mother and a couple of ladies here way back, they used to use the pie crust that got the ooh and ahs from everyone, and they said you have to use lard and make sure that it is rendered lard. And their crust was out of this world. Tender, brown, and flaky.
Wow. Now, okay.
Make those crust anymore, because I tried it and I had more flour on the ceiling than crust.
Well, Wallace, thank you. That just sounds like me. Thanks. Wallace uses rendered lard. Good rendered lard is hard to get, according to what my mother used to say. But, Jerry, you use butter-flavored Crisco.
Yeah, it's just mostly because availability. You're right. Rendered lard is very difficult to get, and it does work. It's just trying to get that amount.
Right. Yeah, and that's a big debate among bakers is lard or butter. Let's go quickly to Bernadette in Fox Point. Bernadette, good morning.
Oh, good morning. I'm on my way to the gym so I can eat extra pie this Thanksgiving.
Great move. Excellent. So when you sit down and have that pie, what kind of pie is it going to be?
Probably pecan.
Okay. Well, no shame in that. You know, say it with confidence. We're going to have pecan pie.
You betcha.
Yeah, okay. So what? Are you making the pie or is someone else?
I'm baking everything, also a whiskey cake. But anyway.
Okay. That could be just baking the whiskey cake could be fun. Bernadette, thanks for sharing, and good luck at the gym, and I hope that works out for you. Jerry, what kind of pie is going to be on your Thanksgiving table this year?
Well, a favorite of mine, and I'm just a traditionalist, is just a double crust blueberry pie. I love those little tiny Maine blueberries, and it's just the sweetness of it. And I put a little extra in for my family, though. I do add a little touch of lemon and brandy.
Okay, well, and blueberries always look great on your tie. Jerry Bouchard, thanks so much for joining us this morning. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
I hope you have a happy Thanksgiving.
You also.
Jerry Bouchard is the owner of the world-famous Norske Nook, a regional restaurant chain with locations in Rice Lake, Hayward, DeForest, and Osseo. They've won awards for their pie. He's also the author of the Norske Nook Book of Pies and Other Recipes. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here is producer Maureen McCullum with a story about some delicious traditional food.
Fry bread appears to have originated in the 1800s when the U.S. government forced many American Indians to move onto reservations. They were given commodities like flour, lard, and sugar to survive. Fry bread is now a staple in many Native American diets, including in Catherine Denemy's. She lives on the Bad River Reservation in northern Wisconsin, but she's originally from the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. Denemy recently showed WPR's Daniel Kading how she makes fry bread.
Making the dough right now. Measure out the flour, yeast, salt, sugar, and put my oil and milk in there and mix it up. When I first started, I was about 19. My mom taught me how to make it. She baked out. I always thought it baked. So we wouldn't starve, I guess. I don't know. And then I've had other women teach me through the years. We used to go to a lot of Powell's when I was younger. And I remember my mom being one of the main cooks for the feast. So that's all I remember is her cooking all day. So I knew, because I can do it now, she's the one that taught me. So she taught me how to make a living anyways. I seen her cook a lot of food in my life for a bunch of people, and I guess I got it in my blood. People always listen over a piece of fried bread. The young kids, they like to talk, so that's when you teach them. Keep their mouth full, and they'll listen. For me, it's a living, and it's something that Indian people eat year-round. It's not just a special. It's something we use every day. A lot of people don't make it no more by hand. And a lot of old ladies do, but not the younger ones. I don't know too many people that can make bread by hand anymore without a machine. And that's it. And then I fry it 400 degrees. And then it cooks the bread. You cook it on one side and then you flip it over and you brown it on the other side, then it's done. It's just the way we've known to make bread. We've had to make our bread over open fire. We never had ovens or anything, so usually when you make fry bread, it's a long time ago, it used to be made outside. You used to put it over a fire in a kettle, like a fry pan, and you would just put the whole thing in there. It's not something you need to make in the house or something, you know. You can make it anywhere. So that's why it was good for Indian people, because they could make their bread anywhere they were camped at for a site, you know. So it only takes about a minute or two on each side, and it's good to go.
That story was brought to us by Daniel Kading, WPR's reporter, based in Superior. This story is part of a new project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. We'll explore how panela cheese connects Jalisco, Mexico with Racine. We'll indulge in a Hmong feast in Onalaska. We'll hear family stories about rum cake in Fort Atkinson and a lutefisk dinner in a church basement. It's a discovery of food ways and traditions that celebrate cultures and communities found across Wisconsin. Those stories can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. And we want to hear about your own food traditions. Share them with us on Instagram. Just search for Wisconsin Life. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network.